Tonight on Arena, Siobhan McSweeney of Derry Girl shares her comedy heroes, and in movies, Sea Fever and When All Is Ruined Once Again, up for review. Five one double 51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And we start with movie reviews. As usual on a Thursday evening, we'll be taking a look at Sea Fever from Irish director Nasa Hardiman, who we spoke to earlier in the week. This is a supernatural drama set aboard a small fishing vessel. And from another Irish director and cinematographer, Keith Walsh, we look at his documentary, if that's the right word, When All Is Ruined Once Again. Our reviewers this evening, John McGuire and Angela Flannery. We've also asked John and Angela to select a couple of movies from their respective childhoods, which bring them back to precious memories, perhaps, but particularly which lend themselves to repeated viewing for John and Angela at any rate. But let's start with the new releases. As I said, we spoke to Nasa Hardiman live on the show earlier this week. Her debut feature film, Sea Fever, just been released. Stephen King is giving it a big thumbs up on Twitter this week. So good for Nasa Hardiman on that one. John, for people who haven't who weren't listening to us earlier in the week or haven't heard the basic premise behind Nasa Hardiman's Sea Fever, let us know what it is.
Well, like you say, Sean, it's set aboard a rusty Atlantic fishing boat, and it stars Dougray Scott as an impoverished captain who leads his crew, including his wife and partner, played by Connie Nielsen, into prohibited waters in desperate search of a catch. And when their vessel is snared by an unclassified leviathan with long searching tentacles, it's up to the bookish marine biology student Siobhan, played by Hermione Caulfield, to figure out what this glowing kraken actually is and why the blue goo that seeps out of it is infecting the men and women on board. And now, in the months since I watched it at the Dublin Film Festival, her atmospheric monster movie has taken on a startling new relevance. Back in free and freezing February, I would have read the film as a metaphor for climate change and overfishing and the ongoing debate about the sacrifices required to reverse a century of environmental abuse. But now the themes of it, like you spoke with Nessa just the other evening, have a more immediate and startling relevance.
So yeah, Angela, I think one of the big things, Angela, that I said to Nasa Hardiman earlier in the week was this idea of science and superstition really rubbing up against one another. That seemed to be very important to her in the story. Did you pick that up in the movie?
Yeah, Sean, I did. I mean, right from the beginning, Siobhan, they're not very happy about her boarding this trawler because she has red hair. And apparently that's really a bad omen. You don't go to sea with somebody who's got red hair because it will bring you bad luck. But of course, you know, Siobhan will be logical and scientific about this. And her role is there as a postdoc student, and she has a job to do. And, you know, she has a very different agenda to the agenda of the skipper, Gerard, who is a pretty selfish, greedy, kind of double crossing kind of guy who really just wants to get the biggest fishing haul he possibly can and doesn't really care about the greater good, which is what motivates Siobhan in this film.
Right. Well, let's have a listen to a clip then where the crew of the boat see some fast moving whales. And they regard them as good luck, but Siobhan, played by Hermione Caulfield, is suspicious.
Whales are still one,
eh? Oh, yeah, look. There's two of them. You see it?
Yeah.
And I think there's a cat.
Look, there's another one just behind.
Can you not see them?
No, I can't. It's just the whales aren't usually around fishing lanes. They don't like the noise. Something's wrong.
Don't start that. Whales are a good omen.
The whales are a very good omen.
Another shoal dead ahead. Less than a mile. It's a big one.
Red.
What?
That shoal's moving pretty fast.
Jesus, where did we hit?
There you go, Hermione Caulfield as Siobhan, and among the voices you heard in there as well, Dougray Scott playing the part of the skipper, Connie Nielsen as his wife Freya, and I believe the voice of Jack Hickey there too from Game of Thrones, he playing the character of Johnny, who is the character that brought Siobhan on board. John, we get a sense there, yes, okay, there's an environmental issue here, and there's a that climate aspect of things that you mentioned was part of the story for sure. But we also hear there that there's a good old schlocky B-movie not too far under the surface.
Yeah, that's the whole point. Beneath that shudder raised by how fact is suddenly stranger than fiction, accidentally it has to be said, now we know that, but there's a sturdy, squirmy B-movie here, one that openly references the classics like Alien and The Thing. But Hardiman is skillful enough to do that and to carry those resonances into a new story. And there's suggestions, like you said, about the red hair and the mythical origin and the sea and being that rich source of mythology. But for the most part, she's careful to delineate how these people walk themselves into a crisis through a lack of preparation, through arrogance, and as Angela says, through greed, before she focuses step by step on the extreme measures required to walk themselves out of it. And that's what makes the film as interesting as it is, that she can balance the logical, progressive elements of her story with that kind of B-movie frights and horrors and things that were, you know, boo moments and the things that we weren't expecting.
Yeah, there's a parasite that's followed. That's what they eventually find. There's this parasite that's one enormous organism that's following them around for whatever reason that it's doing that. And within that then, Angela, I think that's where it starts to really have resonances in terms of the situation we all find ourselves in today. Isolation is mentioned. If somebody has been infected by the parasite, they have to be kept separate and the whole boat has to be kept away from everybody else.
Yeah, that's exactly what happens. And it's what I enjoyed most about the film, Sean. It was the questions that it posed and how relevant it is at the moment in our COVID dictated society that we're living in. It just felt so, so relevant. And the question that Hardiman is posing here is, what would you do to save yourself? You know, would you endanger everybody else? Would you stay in quarantine and sacrifice, you know, your own wants for the greater good? And that's really what this film is about. Now, I know that she had written it, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, that this is a couple of years in the making. So there's absolutely no way that she could have known how relevant it was going to be upon its release. And it is, you know, you have to feel bad for her that it's released at this time, because this is a film that I would have much preferred to have seen in the cinema. You know, that the impact on a very large screen of tiny vessel in the middle of the Atlantic would give you such a strong sense of their isolation and their vulnerability there, but that's not, you know, so she loses out in that way. And also I felt the sound would have worked better in the cinema, because sound is a very big element in ratcheting up the tension in a film like this. But it is just absolutely so relevant, and I think that's why people will enjoy watching this as much, you know, even if you're not a sci-fi fan.
Finally then, from you,
normally be the kind of thing that you'd be into.
Sure. Finally then, from you, John, what are you saying in terms of stars? You were lucky enough to see it on the big screen.
Well, back so in you February, I would have said 3 stars, Sean, but these accidental, it's a strange kind of coincidence. It's these kind of accidents. So I would say 4 stars now. It's a film you really want to sit down and watch it just at the current moment.
Right. And except that there are big designs that would be better seen on the big screen. What about you, Angela? I think you had some caveats around it. So maybe give me those and your final judgment in stars. No, have we lost Angela? Oh, you're back.
In some ways, it didn't really work for me, Sean. And it didn't work for me on a couple of levels. I found the character is a little one-dimensional, and Siobhan in particular, her narrative purpose in this is as a scientist, and she's going to solve the mystery of what is the monster. She doesn't have a backstory, so I found her, you know, just not really believable as a character. And the people who are given the backstory in this are the husband-wife skipper team, Freya and Jared, and I just felt that Siobhan needed to be a little bit meatier, so on the basis of that, I would say 3.5 stars.
All right, that's Sea Fever, the NASA Hardiman film, and you can listen back to our interview Monday night's programme, it was, if I have that night right in my head. They're all mixed up at this point. And it's a good opportunity for me to tell you that, in fact, you can listen back to any item. Either tonight's programme will be podcast tomorrow afternoon, or you can podcast previous episodes wherever you get your podcasts as usual, or you can check out the RTE website, rte.ie/radio1/arena. Let's move on then to our second new release, that When All Is Ruined Once Again. I'm calling this a documentary from the Irish cinematographer, editor and director Keith Walsh. And on the surface of this, John, this is the story of what happens when a bypass is built around a town, specifically the town of Gort here. But there's a lot more going on than the simple documenting of a bypass being built.
That's it, exactly, Sean. Nobody is going to want to sit down and watch a documentary about building 100-odd million euro worth of road through West County Galway and down into Clare. But what Walsh has done here, it's a kind of a protest documentary mashed with an ethno documentary like you'd see on the National Geographic. He's put together an assembly of poetic, philosophical, and ethnographic images and interviews in the most startling way, really. It's beautifully photographed in monochrome black and white. And it's essentially a film about encounters with the local people in the land itself as this clanking machinery tries to build this road all the way through what would be an ancient landscape. And it's really very affecting. I found it very affecting anyway. In 2010 or so, when the film starts and the road is starting to be opened, you hear somebody say off camera as the car horns beep and you hear the rush of the tyres on tarmac, it'll never be quiet again. And in Walsh's thesis, the truth of it is that it hadn't been ever quiet. And it's just that you have to listen very carefully to hear the sounds of the landscape as they were before the road was built.
Yeah, as you said, John, it's much more of almost a philosophical statement or treatise this than a traditional narrative documentary. And I want to play a clip that actually gives us a real sense of that. The film deals with how human beings have exploited the planet and its resources. And this piece of narration takes place about 30 minutes into the film, and it's talking about where things went wrong.
I think it went off the rails right at the first page of the Bible. In Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 and 28, when God is saying, "Let us now make man in our image and likeness," and having made man in his image and likeness, he gives them a command, or at least a divine mandate, to rule over the earth and to subdue it and to have dominion over the fish of the sea and the bird of the air. When that got translated into my catechism at school, I mean, the first question in my catechism was, who made the world? And a forest of hands would go up, God. And then the second question, why did God make the world? And the answer to that was, for man's use and benefit. Now that phrase, like use and benefit, if one were to look back at the earth from the moon and this gorgeous blue jewel hanging there in space, like, and to say that that's just for use and benefit. From the word go, our attitude to the earth, our relationship to the earth was all wrong. In the Christian tradition, it is common, I think, to say that you can only sin against another human being or sin against God. You cannot sin against an animal. You cannot sin against a river. You cannot sin against a blade of grass. You can sin against anything. I mean, Christians, we have to open up and say that you can be in a state of sin towards a blade of grass. To look at a tree and see only cubic feet of timber, that is to sin against the tree. When you see anything as smaller or less than what it is, you are sinning against it. When you see something only with an economic eye, you are sinning against it.
That's an extraordinary clip there from When All Is Ruined Once Again, one of the films that John McGuire and Angela Flannery are speaking to me about this evening. And I know that that clip in particular and that idea of sinning against a blade of grass, sinning against a tree or a leaf or whatever it is, Angela, that really spoke to you when you heard it.
Yeah, I mean, that is use and benefit. It's the late, great John Moriarty, the Kerry writer and philosopher, who has a kind of voiceover cameo in this documentary. And I found that really, really affecting. I mean, it's a very, very philosophical film. All of the people that Keith Walsh talks to in this film are philosophers. They're ordinary local people around Gert. But what they have to say and their reflections on life are so moving, so honest, so unpretentious. I just thought this film was a revelation, absolutely a revelation. I couldn't recommend it highly enough, in fact. And that may make it sound quite high-minded, you know, to say that it's an elegy, it's poetic, it's philosophical, but it is so, so accessible and so relatable that it is, you know, just unique and really, really moving.
Yeah, in fact, the title itself gives us a sense at the very beginning of the film. John, I'll come to you on this one. The title, When All Is Ruin, once again, a quote from Yeats.
That's right, to be carved on a stone at Tour Ballylee. And one of the very first things we see is from the floods of, I think it was 2015, although it has been flooded a couple of times, where we approach the tour on a boat in this most astonishing monochrome, slow-moving approach to the tower. And Yeats, it's not really, Yeats doesn't really figure in as a figure, if you know what I mean. But the kind of things that Yeats found so interesting about that part of Ireland is what the film is about as well. The people, the landscape, the folklore, the quiet way of life that they had. And to me, the way that Walsh joins these elements together is so careful and so sensitive. It could only have come from being completely immersed, as he was, in these communities over the 7 years of production. And it's his reflection on that world, the natural world and the human world, mortality, economics, the uncertain fate of these ancient communities on the margins of progress. And the way that he gathers all of these elements together, new stuff that he shot, archive footage, as we just heard John Moriarty and other speakers in voiceover, it's really an exceptional assembly. It's something that once you turn it on, you're not going to turn it off until it's over. You really get into it. And we do make these films here. It reminded me of Pat Collins's documentary Living in a Coded Land, and just down in Clare, Katrina Costello's The Silver Branch, which is shot on the Burren. And they're two recent films that, like Walsh, make unexpected links between the land, the people, the past and the future.
Stars from you, John?
All five. This is a great film, Sean. This is a great film. Five. There's no denying it. It's a great film.
Five from John. What are you saying overall, Angela, and stars to finish up?
Yeah, I actually found it hard to even consider rating this. It's a work of art and it feels, I mean, I'll give it five, but it feels that I'm cheapening it even by giving it, you know, kind of doing a thumbs up gesture for it. It is an absolutely extraordinary achievement. And I think that it's something in years to come that film students will be watching. It'll be a piece of social history and, remarkable.
Yeah, economic value and star value is not what Keith Walsh was looking for, but I'm sure he'll be quite happy with two sets of five stars for the film there.
Oh, yeah.
The title of it has just gone out of me head. When All Is Ruined Once Again, do beg your pardon. All right, now it's a little bit of fun to finish up with. Angela, we asked both yourself and John to pick films from childhood that spoke to you in a particular type of way. You know, I don't think I need to introduce too much about this film other than to actually play a clip from it. And when I say even the names of the characters, I think people will have a fair idea of what exactly it is that I'm talking about. Danny, played by John Travolta. Sandy, played by Olivia Newton-John, have had a lovely summer romance, but Sandy was to return to her home in Australia. But as school starts up again, Betty Rizzo, Stockard Channing, surprises Danny with the arrival of a new student to Rider High. Danny, who is the leader of the T-Birds gang, shows a side to Sandy that she doesn't recognise.
Hey, Sokol!
I got a surprise for you.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Sandy!
Danny?
What are you doing here? I thought you were going back to Australia.
We had a change of plans.
I can't...
Well, that's cool, baby. I mean, you know how it is. Rockin' and rollin' and whatnot.
Danny?
That's my name. Don't wear it out.
What's the matter with you?
What's the matter with me, baby? What's the matter with you?
Yeah. What happened to the Danny Zuko I met at the beach?
Well, I do not know. I mean, maybe maybe there's two of us, right? Why don't you take out a missing persons ad or try the yellow pages? I don't know.
You're a fake and a phony, and I wish I'd never laid eyes on you.
Whoa. Whoa.
I wonder if she carries silver bullets.
Yeah.
Oh, Danny, 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 you naughty boy, played by John Travolta there. Olivia Newton-John as Sandy and Stocker Channing as Betty Rizzo. Grease, of course, is the movie, Angela. When did you start watching this? What age were you when you were allowed to watch it first, I guess?
I was 12, Sean, but I mean, the film came out in 1978. I wasn't 12 in 1978, but when I was 12, we got a VHS recorder, which was a really big deal. This is 1982, and we didn't know anyone else that had them, and we only had three films, and one of them was Grease, and the other two were The Jazz Singer and The Good, The Bad and The Ugly. So Grease was the one that was most age appropriate for us. It was a bit risque, you know, definitely. I mean, there's references, there's a lot of necking going on in it, and it was the first time I'd heard the term hickey. And there's a great line in it, actually, where Kanicki, who's going out with Rizzo, says to her, hey, baby, a hickey from Kanicki's like a Hallmark card. And I just love that. It's nearly as good as, you know, that's my name, baby, don't wear it out, which Travolta said there. But, you know, yeah, it was an incredibly exciting film to watch at 12, particularly because we could watch it over and over and over again, which is something kids take for granted now, or, you know, just a different generation, DVDs. You know, just being able to turn stuff on and keep watching it. That just didn't happen when I was a kid. And also, you know, before I was 12, we lived in rural Ireland and we had one television station through the 70s and there was no cinema nearby. So this was the first time that I actually, you know, watched something so much that I could have told you every word in it. And of course, the music in it and the costumes and everything. It was very, very appealing to a 12-year-old imagination.
Yeah. When did you last watch it?
A couple of years ago, and I do think that it kind of stands the test of time because it's got this kitsch kind of, it's very fun, you know, the music is fantastic in it, and it's great to, you know, just to look at Travolta at that age as well. I mean, how old was he making? Maybe 23, 24, but yeah. That is something that struck me. These people are supposed to be teenagers, and Stockard Channing, who plays Rizzo in it, was 33 at the time. So it's dated, but it's nostalgia anyway. You know, supposed to be the 50s. It was made in the 70s. So watching it today, I don't think it loses that much, to be honest.
Let's move on then to your childhood memory, John. The Adventures of... well, it's two films, actually, both about Sherlock Holmes. Oh, have we lost John? I'll tell you what, let's play a clip from the Sherlock Holmes and we'll see if we can get John back while we're listening to it. This is from the opening to The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes from 1939. It's the second in the series. Sherlock Holmes, Basil Rathbone playing him here, encounters Professor Moriarty, played by George Zuko, outside the Old Bailey, where Moriarty has just been acquitted of murder.
Well, there you are, Holmes. I'm afraid you have a bad opinion of me.
On the contrary, I hold you in the highest esteem, but only as a knave.
Gratifying to know that one's talents are appreciated by such a distinguished connoisseur. May I give you a lift? Cabs are scarce in this rain.
Thank you.
You've a magnificent brain, Moriarty. I admire it. I admire it so much I'd like to present it pickled in alcohol to the London Medical Society.
That would make an interesting exhibit. Holmes, you've only now barely missed sending me to the gallows. You're the one man in England clever enough to defeat me.
The situation has become impossible.
Have you any suggestions?
I'm going to break you, Holmes. I'm going to bring off right under your nose the most incredible crime of the century, and you'll never suspect it until it's too late. That will be the end of you, Mr. Sherlock Holmes.
Well, here we are at my lodgings. I'm so sorry I can't ask you in. Good night, Professor Moriarty.
Good night.
There you go, Basil Rathbone and George Zuko in The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes from 1939. And I know, John, that you're also saying that we should watch the previous film, The Hound of the Baskervilles. Just briefly, why?
Why? Well, sitting on the couch in front of the TV on a Sunday afternoon as a child in the house I grew up in, Sean, when you ask me what film brings me right back there, it's Basil Rathbone's beaky profile. He's like a folded umbrella in a deerstalker hat. That's the first image that pops into my head. And it's not so much The Hound of the Baskervilles and The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, which were both released in 1939, produced by Daryl Zanuck, with Rathbone and Nigel Bruce as Dr. Watson. They were A pictures with big budgets, high production values, box office hits. They were produced by Fox, 20th Century Fox. When the estate of Arthur Conan Doyle came back to Fox and said, you've made a lot of money, we want a better deal, and Fox denied them, the films then went over to Universal. Universal Pictures was a cheaper house. They were making B movies, and they made, 14 Sherlock Holmes movies very, very quickly in a burst, with the same cast, more or less, but they set them in what was then contemporary times in the 1940s. So it wasn't Victorian adventures anymore. These were films about fighting the Nazis, uncovering spies, protecting advanced weapons secrets, unbreakable codes, helping the war effort. There were 12 of them in a rush between 1942 and 1945 by an Irishman, produced and directed by an Irishman called Roy William Neal. And those are the films that I adore because they're B-movies. They're simple. They're like the leaflet you get with an IKEA piece of flatback furniture. You could follow them along with the arrows. They're as simple as can be, and they're wonderful. They're absolutely wonderful. And I just wrap up, Sean, by saying that quite a few of them have fallen into the public domain and you can watch them on YouTube, and I highly recommend it.
Okay, not sure about the easiness of assembling flatback furniture, but we'll leave that one go. John McGuire and Angela Flannery there speaking to us about their childhood movies and the two movies that we reviewed, When All Is Ruined Once Again from Keith Walsh and Nasa Hardiman's Sea Fever. Well, it may seem that there's very little to laugh about at the moment, but Siobhan McSweeney, known to all of us as Sister Michael from Derry Girls, joins us from London to share some of her comedy heroes. They range from the classically trained actor turned comedian Gene Wilder to EGOT winner, that's Emmy, Grammy, Oscar and Tony Award winner Whoopi Goldberg, and finally the English double act French and Saunders. These are the comedians who are keeping her laughing at this unprecedented time. And Siobhan joins me now. Good to have you with us this evening, Siobhan. Let's start with Gene Wilder. What was your first introduction to him? I presume Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, like most of us.
Let's start and end with Gene Wilder. He is my everything. He's known as Mr. McSweeney in this household. He first came into my life with Willy Wonka, and I was convinced Willy Wonka would be on every year at Christmas time, which is when my birthday as well. And I was convinced that this film was made specifically for me. So it was a very special present for me, his presence. So that film started everything. Just his performance in that. I mean, it's not comic. It's very, very strange. And looking back on it, at times, very, very disturbing. But there's a glint in his eye. There's a glint in his eye and a turn of his mouth, and that he uses so forensically well in the rest of his repertoire, the rest of the films that he's done. So I've picked him because he makes me laugh so much.
Well, let's get into then the specifics of when the adult Siobhan McSweeney then was looking at Gene Wilder and seeing his more comedy-driven work. Young Frankenstein, I guess, would be a good starting point there.
Well, it was more his earlier stuff with Mel Brooks, actually. The Producers, Blazing Saddles. Young Frankenstein then was the one that he wrote and starred in. And so he got to sort of have full reign with what he wanted to do there. But what I love about Gene, and I suppose something that sort of runs with the other two people I've picked as well, is that, I mean, Gene is, you know, classically trained. He went to the Bristol Old Vic here in the UK. He studied the Stanislavskian method. His first film appearance was in Bonnie and Clyde. You know, like he's for want of a better phrase, he's a straight actor. And it just sort of reinforces to me the fact that comedy is the hardest thing to do. It's far harder to do than straight acting. And if you can do comedy, you can do straight acting. It doesn't usually work the other way around. And he's able to bring all this craft, all this training into something that is so forensic. It's so good. Like, are you going to play a clip from Blazing Saddles?
Yes. Will we play the one where he's saying why he isn't the Waco kid anymore? Would that be a good example of this forensic nature?
Yeah, and there's another one. If you look at like the way he takes his poses, I mean, that was another difficulty. I must apologise. Just like I have a great face for radio, I wasn't able to pick great clips for the radio because the comedy I like is actually quite visual, which doesn't translate well. But this is wonderful anyway. Listen away. Hope you enjoy it.
All right, so Blazing Saddles, 1974. Jim, played by Gene Wilder, is explaining to the new sheriff, Bart, played by Cleavon Little, why he isn't the Wicko kid anymore.
You are the kid.
Was. Yeah, I was the kid.
Well, what happened?
Oh, well, it got so that every pissant prairie punk who thought he could shoot a gun would ride into town to try out the Wicko kid. I must have killed more men than Cecil B. DeMille. Got pretty gritty. I started to hear the word draw in my sleep. And one day, I was just walking down the street, and I heard a voice behind me say, "Reach for it, mister." And I spun around, and there I was, face to face with a 6-year-old kid. Well, I just threw my guns down and walked away. Little bastard shot me in the ass.
And there you go. That's Gene Wilder there as the Wicko kid, although he's not called the Wicko kid anymore, is he? And he, new Sheriff Bart there, played by Cleavon Little. Gene Wilder, one of the comedy heroes of Siobhan McSweeney, who's speaking to me from London this evening. He has that deadpan quality that many comedians seem to possess, Siobhan.
I think, I mean, that clip is sort of perfect because up until the very last line, this is a heartbreaking monologue. This is said with extreme sincerity. You're with them. You're thinking, my gosh, where is this going to go? And then you build it up and you just knock it out then with, and he shot me in the ass. And like, that's genius. That's strength of not being able to fall for the immediate laugh. That's discipline. The deadpan thing. Yeah, he's deadpan, but he's also like, I mean, he's deadpan in this particular moment. I sort of think it's more he's melancholic. He's not deadpan. I wouldn't call him deadpan, for example, in The Producers. He's completely frenetic and hyper, and he's able to do so many things on the turn. Turns so quickly. His craft is extraordinary. Like, if I think there's another clip that's coming up, and I mean, if you hadn't heard it before, if I told you that it was Beckett, you'd believe it.
This is again Blazing Saddles you're talking about here.
Just the very short one.
Yeah, little short sharp joke between Bart, again Cleavon Little, and Jim, Gene Wilder.
If you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits? Different types who wear a day coat, pants with stripes or cutaway coat, perfect fits. Dressed up like a $1 million trooper, trying mighty hard to look like Gary Cooper.
Okay, well, that wasn't quite what we were looking for, but it does give us a sense of his versatility. That was from Young Frankenstein, Gene Wilder, and their version of Putting on the Ritz, the monster played by Peter Boyle. But I do have that clip that you were speaking about, Siobhan McSweeney, Blazing Saddles, Bart played by Cleavon Little, and Jim played by Gene Wilder.
Hey, maybe you should eat something first.
No, thanks. Food makes me sick.
Oh. A man drink like that and he don't eat, he is going to die.
When?
There you go. Cleveland Little
we got there eventually.
And Gene Wilder. But it is, I see what you're saying about the Beckettian influence and the visual side of it as well is, you know, the big gulping of the drink is important within that as well, Siobhan.
Yes, and it's the absolute sincerity with which he does everything. There's no, for something to be really funny, you have to play it like all these crap sayings, but like you have to play it straight. You have to believe at that moment that the monster is going to sing Putting on the Ritz. You have to believe that putting him in a tails and a top hat is going to convince people that he has this civilized monster. Like, whatever, even though the situation is extraordinary, the belief with which he and the sincerity with which he approaches every situation it's just comic genius. It's gold. Absolute gold.
Right, let's move on then to Whoopi Goldberg and a film that I suppose many people won't be familiar with, Jumpin' Jack Flash, the film. They'll know the song for sure. But tell us a little bit about the film.
Well, the film is one of her first films, actually. It's from the 80s. I remember it was a film that we got a lot when we got a video player and the local shop had it, so we watched it quite a few times, and I remember actually our very first video player was, I can't even call it a VHS player, it was so huge, it was the size of a small lawnmower, and it sort of smelt the same, it smelt of diesel. I've no idea, I've never seen anything before or since, but we watched that, myself and my brother, we watched it all the time. It is absolutely brilliant. And Whoopi is extraordinary for a trillion reasons. But this is a film, I think it's 1986 it came out in. And this is a film in 1986. She's playing a romantic lead. She's young. It's one of her first films. She's a black woman. She's a woman with a very certain aesthetic. And she is being played as a romantic lead, and like in a big film. People may not know it now, but it's a feature film. It's a big movie. She was able to carry that at this time, which is really quite extraordinary. Because I sort of feel like we've lost a lot of that now. Like who's doing that now? This film, if you haven't seen it, do yourself a favour. Go and watch it tonight. It is just some beautiful stuff altogether. It really, really is class. You get to see her dress as like Tina Turner at one point. She does this. She is extraordinary when it comes to physical comedy. Her, like again, like Jean, she's classically trained. She studied under Uta Hagen. She started off in this avant-garde troupe. Whoopi is an extraordinary performer. And as time goes by and more I personally work, the more extraordinary she seems. Enjoy it.
You mentioned the whole idea earlier on about, you know, that comedy is the hardest business in the world. And when it comes to drunk acting, you have to be very careful, in fact, not to act drunk, but in fact, to act that you're trying desperately to look sober. And in the clip we're about to hear, she is drunk here, or she was to be drunk at any point. Terry is the character's name. She's had a very stressful few days. She turns up to work, bit the worse for wear, it has to be said. She's in no mood to deal with her boss, Mr. Page, played by Peter Michael Guts. And he happens to be wearing a wig.
Congratulations, Miss Doolittle. You have finally managed to shatter the Guinness record for tardiness. I'm taking you upstairs.
I'm not going to say anything. Maybe one or two things. Psst, come here. All six of you, come here.
Look.
I've just had several of the worst days of my young life, Mr. Page. And, well, the last thing I need is some jighead like you to be screaming at me in a whiny voice. You'll leave me alone. I'm gonna snatch this bad boy off your head.
Oh, no.
And have to ram this straight up your old chocolate whiz way.
Oh, my God.
Get Larry the heavyset guard. Get Larry the heavyset guard.
Larry the heavyset guard needs to get there quickly.
The heavyset guard.
Terry, played by Whoopi Goldberg, one of the Whoopi Goldberg, one of the comedy heroes of Siobhan McSweeney, who's speaking with me this evening. And there is a great physical comedy in that section in that film as well, Siobhan, where she's trying to work out the lyrics of Jumping Jack Flash. It doesn't really work as an auditory thing, but visually it is quite stunning. Let's move on to your third, I suppose, two heroes here, really, in French and Saunders. When did you first come across their comedy?
The clip that I was thinking specifically of when it came to French and Saunders is one that I don't know how we had it, because we only had RT1 and RT2, but for some reason we must have gotten Top of the Pops. I still to this day don't know how we had Top of the Pops. And they used to do the comic relief songs here, where they'd do sort of parodies of the songs, or they'd be in the video of the music video of the song. And this one in particular, I remember standing and walking close to the television, because just feeling so drawn and understanding complete and wanting to see what it was. And it was the song Love Letters, sung by Alison Moyet. And it's a very simple premise, like all good comedy, really simple premise, which, so therefore, you know, it's incredibly hard to do. And Alison Moyet is singing with her beautiful voice, singing Love Letters, and in walks Dawn French. And she does what every clown since the beginning of time has done, and she's trying to upstage Alison Moyet. Like, years and years and years later, I discovered the very first outing of Charlie Chaplin as his tramp character. And it's nearly exactly the same. I mean, there's obviously no Alison Moyet, but this clown tendency to be doing whatever you're doing, look over, look to the audience, see that there's an audience there, and try to distract and try to get up to mischief. It is the most glorious piece. And Dawn in particular, I mean, the pair of them are perfectly suited. That's not a radical thing to say. Everybody knows that. But Dawn French, I love what she does as her part in French and Saunders. She's a proper, sexy, mischievous, smart, bold clown. And there's not enough of them around.
Yeah, and as you say, again, in the
and
Alison
if they
Moyet
are, they're all in government.
The Alison Moyet thing is quite a visual side to it. But you did also give us a suggestion about Dawn French and her Catherine Zeta-Jones impersonation. Let's listen to the clip, actually. She does her take on Hollywood royalty, Catherine Zeta-Jones.
My body always looks this top when I'm not up the duff. Mind you, I'm always up the duff, because I'm living under a conceiving moon, aren't I? The gloomy moon, the sucky, sizzly LA sun in the day, and the orby, spermy moon at night. The rooting, rutting moon. I tell you, Michael is roaring for it when it's hot, and it's always hot out here. Mind you, I gotta feel sorry for him, because it's a proper condition, see? He's addicted to the sexuals. No, serious, it's really medical. So for his health, I got to have it off with him often as possible. You know, let the dog see the rabbit. Bam, bam, another sprog, result.
There you go. Catherine Zeta-Jones, it wasn't. Dawn French, it was. Easy to work out why she's one of your heroes. Thanks a million for joining us this evening, Siobhan McSweeney, to share those heroes with us. And look after yourself in London. That's Siobhan McSweeney with our comedy heroes for us this evening. Gene Wilder, Whoopi Goldberg, and French and Saunders. Now, The Works Presents returns for a new season tonight. First up for Profile is Graeme Chatten, the charismatic lead singer of the Fontaines DC. Let's hear a clip from it right now, where Graeme talks about his love of poetry and the encouragement his father has given him.
It was my dad that got me into poetry and lyricism when I was very young. I used to bounce words off him, and he'd always kind of respond by saying, you know, what's the point in it unless it's sort of like complete or if it's contextualised, you know what I mean? Because I used to kind of like run around looking for validation on one line. I'm glad that he sort of pushed me to expand on it, you know what I mean? And every time I learned the poem off by her, he'd buy me a pack of football stickers. So I started learning loads of poetry, and it was just very, very simple. To kind of, if there was enough of a device in it, then it was easy to hang on to, you know. And then, I've filled up the whole sticker book.
Graham Chapman there speaking to John Kelly on The Works Presents, and you can see the full programme tonight on RTÉ1 Television, 11:15. The 32 is an anthology of working class voices currently under construction by editor Paul McVeigh, author of The Good Son. The 32 will be a collection of essays and memoirs from Irish writers from working class backgrounds. 16 contributions will be from well-known authors, including Kevin Barry, Lisa McInerney and Roddy Doyle. The other 16 will be from emerging and unpublished writers. And Paul McVeigh is in the process of recruiting these 16 emerging or unpublished writers literally as we speak. And he's joining me now. Paul, we spoke to the writer Kit Duvall in the recent past about Common People, which was her anthology of working class writers. The 32 is the Irish version of that anthology?
Yes, that's right. The anthology that she did was a huge success, and we're hoping to recreate that here in Ireland.
And the fact that it's called the 32 gives us an idea that it's the island that we're talking about.
That's correct. Yeah, the mechanism didn't exist here for writers to apply to the UK version that she was doing. So Kit had been going around festivals in Ireland, and lots of authors had been asking her, "Will there be an Irish version of the anthology?" And here it is. Yes, we're ready to go.
Yeah, I remember at the time when we spoke with her that she was saying, yes, we have to start getting the ball rolling and all of that. And obviously the ball did start to roll, and hence I'm speaking with you this evening. Class is a contentious issue everywhere, Britain and Ireland for sure. So how do you define who or what a working class writer is?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think people can get quite cross about it and I think in Ireland in particular it is an issue that's not as clear that it may be elsewhere. And so I've decided to not get involved too much in arguments about what constitutes a working class writer. I mean, there's no test that, you know, exists that I know of, and that certainly would be uncontested. So the way we've worked it here for the anthology specifically is to let people self-identify, and that in itself can raise a few eyebrows. But the idea is that, you know, it's, look, we're not the Dole office, we're not the tax office, we're not trying to catch anybody out. You know, we kind of, you know, are letting people say that they are working class, and if you're working class, you know it, you know, and you know what effect that's had in your life, and that's what we're trying to do. We're just trying to get these stories from working class people who want to make it in the writing world, and give them a leg up, and so they tell us that they're working class, and we'll go along with that. We're not going to send any police around to check them out or anything.
Yeah, but we're not talking fiction here. We're talking memoir and essays.
That's
why,
right,
particularly the non-fiction mode to explore this? I presume we're exploring the working class experience in the memoir writing and essays.
That's basically why. I mean, we really want to, you know, hear the myriad of experience that working class people have, and there's a danger that working class life becomes this kind of stereotype, and that there's only one story that reflects it. And in fact, there's a huge array of experiences. You know, you can basically, some people, for example, experience a fluidity around their working class life, and they move from one class to another, either because they're some, you know, one of their parents got a job that sort of took them away out of that life, or they themselves, by going to university and afterwards going into an industry that's seen as working middle class. But then there's this feeling that maybe even when that happens, that you never really leave your working class roots. So I want to hear as many different stories as possible, and get this away from this idea that there is just this one story around being working class.
What about the 16 established writers? I think you know who they are, if my understanding is correct at this point. Do you have the 16 pieces of writing in your paw yet?
I have I have maybe four or five of them, and they're very good, and they're fantastic, as you would expect from the caliber of the people. But some people haven't written before. I mean, we've got Senator Lynn Rowan, and we have a real mixture of Rick O'Shea, in fact, a presenter from RTE, and we have an editor. And one of the reasons for that for me was that, you know, for example, Martin Doyle, you know, is the literary editor of the Irish Times, and, you know, as a working class boy from the north. And, you know, and I think that, you know, growing up in Ardoyne, and, you know, if I'd have known that the literary editor of the Irish Times was a working class boy from Northern Ireland, it would have made a difference to me. That, you know, I would have felt that, oh wow, okay, so that's something that I can aspire to. It's that idea that you have to see it to be it, you know, to aspire to it, you know, that you have to see these people that exist. And and that's one of the things that I was interested in when I was choosing the authors.
So you have your 16 established, but you are still looking for people who want to be considered as, you know, maybe starting out writers, haven't written anything at all before, or emerging writers. What do they need to do?
That's right. Well, they basically need to write a piece of memoir, up to 2,500 words, and send that to the 32 at unbound.co.uk with a 500-word statement. Just about themselves. You can go onto the Unbound website and look for the 32, and on there, there's more details as well. You go to my Twitter page, and there's lots of places where you can have a look at the information, and you know, send your work in. We actually had a deadline of May 1st. We're now just tonight announcing that you know, we're going to extend that to Friday, May 15th, just because this has been a bit of an odd time, and people have found time a very strange thing at the moment. And we just wanted to give a little bit of breathing space around for anyone who wanted to apply.
And you've spoken to us before about this, you know, the tyranny of the blank page. So if somebody is there listening this evening thinking, you know, I have something to say, but there's a big blank screen or blank page in front of me, how would you, what's your advice to them on how to approach that?
Well, I think that, you know, focusing on the senses has always been a really good starting place for me. You know, I mean, if you're thinking of taking the angle of going from to recount a specific point in time, a specific event in your life, you know, go there and try and conjure up for the reader what that was like, and by writing your senses into those. Every sentence, or, you know, there should be all five sentences should be there in every page. It will bring it alive to those who read it. And, you know, I think that really helps a lot to make your story come off the page.
Yeah, the sense is certainly a good starting point for most things. And that's Paul McVeigh with that piece of advice if you are an emerging writer and thinking of submitting. Now, you have until the 15th of May, as Paul said to us, to be considered for this 32 anthology. Submission should be in the form of a Word document, and that can be either .doc or .docx. So it doesn't matter what version of Word you have. It would seem, you know, reasonably recent will get you there. And you email that to the 32 at unbound.co.uk. Now, earlier when we were speaking about the films, I forgot to tell you that all of the films we were speaking about are available online on Vimeo. You can find the documentary When All Is Ruined Once Again. You'll find that on Vimeo from this Friday, whereas Sea Fever, the NASA Hardiman movie, can be found on Sky, on iTunes, on Amazon and Google Play. Lots of different platforms, in fact, for it in that particular case. But that is our lot for this Thursday evening here on Arena. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Kieran Cullen was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme produced by Keshi. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.